Blowing the whistle on possible wrongdoing can come with a price. If there's retribution, the protections are weak.
And under that administrative process, who is responsible for ensuring that it is properly enforced? The answer to that is Donald Trump.
Also today, the app TikTok might seem harmless. People can share a short dance video or a lip sync. But TikTok is Chinese-owned, and that brings along Chinese rules.
Chinese government is not only able to censor people in China or people who do business with China, you know, the government is not able to censor people who have nothing to do with China.
And angry protests in Egypt and on the floor of Britain's parliament.
No shame today. No shame at all.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. Who is the whistleblower? That's the question many would like to know the answer to, but we really shouldn't be asking. Whistleblower laws are meant to protect people's identity, to encourage them to come forward and call out corruption and remain protected. In Washington, the whistleblower on everybody's mind took considerable personal and professional risk by saying that President Trump abused his power when he asked the new Ukrainian president for political favors. When a whistleblower's identity is revealed, the consequences can be a nightmare. President Trump doesn't seem too concerned. In an audio recording from a private event in New York yesterday, Trump wanted to know who supplied the whistleblower with information.
You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? With spies and treason. We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
Yesterday's recording was obtained by the Los Angeles Times. So let's enroll in Whistleblowing 101. David Colapinto is the co-founder of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington. He also serves as their general counsel.
There's two phases to a whistleblower case. We're in the first phase where the whistleblower submitted his or her concerns. They've now gotten to Congress. That's phase one. Phase two is if the whistleblower is identified and suffers retaliation by his or her agency, then phase two would kick in and they would have to file a complaint through the administrative process, depending upon where you work and who you report to.
So what exactly are the protections then? If you're a whistleblower, how are you protected from any of this?
Whistleblower protections for federal employees generally are weak. And for someone who works in the intelligence community, like we're dealing with this whistleblower in the news this week, the protections are even worse. If something were to happen to this intelligence community whistleblower, say the person gets fired tomorrow, they could file a complaint through an administrative process within the intelligence community. But do you know who has the authority to make the final decision in that case? The Director of National Intelligence. No judicial review. There's no right to file a complaint in court. There's no right to bring a retaliation case to a jury of your peers. And under that administrative process, who is responsible for ensuring that it is properly enforced? The answer to that is Donald Trump, the President of the United States.
How do U.S. whistleblower laws compare to what other countries have in place?
Believe it or not, overall, the whistleblower laws in the United States are stronger than most countries. That is true for both government employees and in the private sector. The European Union, for example, has just recently mandated that corporations in Europe establish whistleblowing procedures. The principles that they adopted are very good. They have yet to be fully implemented, and we'll see how that goes. But up until this time, it has been very difficult in a lot of countries around the world.
What is your reaction to Trump's comments calling the whistleblower, quote, almost a spy, not to mention his allusion to executions for traitors and spies?
It is shocking, absolutely shocking, that the head of the United States government, whose duty it is to enforce the laws, would make such a statement comparing someone who has followed the rules by reporting misconduct, which is being verified every day. The fact that the president would say such a thing is just truly astonishing, and it shows how disconnected from reality he is. I'm not even sure the president understands what his role is.
What are you going to be looking out for as this drama continues to unfold?
The number one thing is to protect the whistleblower. The comments by the president are very disturbing, and if the identity of the whistleblower is unmasked against that person's will, then retaliation is sure to follow. Certainly, there will be a smear campaign, and that is the biggest concern. The rest will take care of itself in terms of Congress analyzing and investigating what happened and whether or not any action needs to be taken under the Constitution.
David Colapinto is the general counsel for the National Whistleblower Center in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
As you just heard, whistleblowers can pay a heavy price for speaking out. They risk their jobs, their safety, their family's safety, and the fallout can continue for years. That's what happened to Dr. Xuping Wang. She helped expose China's HIV blood contamination crisis in the 1990s. Wang died last week in the U.S. at the age of 59. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has her story.
In the 1990s, Xuping Wang was a doctor in Henan Province in central China. She was assigned to work at a blood plasma collection clinic. At the time, poor farmers were selling their blood at these government-run clinics. And in the rush to make more money, clinics took some shortcuts, like reusing needles and not screening for diseases. And they would also mix blood from multiple donors, extract the plasma, and then re-inject the red blood cells back into the donors. Wang began to suspect problems, and when she ran tests on the blood samples, she found high levels of hepatitis C and later HIV. Wang immediately reported her findings to a local health official, and she described his reaction in an interview just this month with the BBC.
I said, it's very dangerous. He said, really? I said, yes. Wow, you did a great job. Our people will thank you in the future.
He said he would report her findings up the chain, but he didn't. When she confronted him about it, she says he tried to discredit her findings. So Wang took her samples to Beijing, confirmed her results there, and wrote a report. She says she started getting harassing calls almost immediately.
The local government began to say, what are you doing? You make big earthquake for us.
She said officials tried to shut down her clinic, intimidate her, and rough her up. She said at one point, a thug probably hired by local leaders came to her testing site and started smashing up her equipment. When she tried to stop him, he hit her with his baton. But her message still got out. In 1996, blood collection clinics all over China were shut down and reopened with mandatory HIV testing for donors. But Wang said she still faced intimidation. She had embarrassed local officials and cost them money, and now it was going to cost her her job.
They asked me to stay home and work for your husband, and they didn't pay me money. I lost my marriage. Finally, I feel I want to have a job. I want to work. I don't want to stay home. So I began looking for a job in America.
Wang immigrated to the United States in 2001. The same year, a senior Chinese official conceded for the first time that the country had an HIV epidemic and a cover-up by local officials made it worse. More than 500,000 people were believed to have become infected after selling their blood to clinics. Wang ended up getting a job in Utah, remarrying, and having two more children in the U.S., but that wasn't the end of it. As recently as last month, she said her friends and family back in China got threatening calls from the Chinese authorities. They were trying to get Wang to stop a play about her life that's being performed now at a theater in London.
The officer asked a lot of questions. They want to stop the show because they think the show can damage their reputation.
Wang died of an apparent heart attack on Saturday. She was 59. Shortly before she died, she said in an interview, "Speaking out cost me my job, my marriage, and my happiness at the time. But it also helped save the lives of thousands and thousands of people." For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Here's one story you may have missed this week in the midst of whistleblower headlines. The U.S. military says it killed 17 suspected Islamic State militants in a series of airstrikes in Libya. The attacks were carried out near the southern town of Morzouk. Libya is in chaos. The government is fighting multiple rebel offensives, and this has allowed ISIS to exploit the security vacuum. My BBC colleague Orla Guerin has this report from the capital, Tripoli.
We traveled to the southern edge of Tripoli, now a suburban battlefield. This is the heart of Libya's latest conflict, but foreign players are also involved in what is increasingly another proxy war in the Middle East.
From this direction, maybe 600 meters from this point, is a fire line.
The commander, Salem bin Ismail, showed us the front line that many have died to protect. He's a veteran of the revolution of 2011 and said he's still fighting to defend democracy.
I hope this is the last of the wars. We need ballot boxes and elections. We fought against Gaddafi to get rid of military control. The Libyan people want democracy. Circumstances have made us fight again.
He and his men are fighting to defend Tripoli on behalf of the UN-recognized government. It has the support of Turkey and Qatar. They're holding off forces led by a rebel commander, General Khalifa Haftar. He's backed by Egypt, the UAE, France and Russia. Well, the fighting has been grinding on here since April, much of it unseen. But there is active firing taking place today. And what happens on this front line has implications far beyond Tripoli. The fear is that if this conflict continues, it could push Libya into all-out civil war. With the government focused on defending the capital, there's a moment of opportunity for groups including the Islamic State or Daesh, according to the Interior Minister Fatih Beshaga.
This is very good chance for Al-Qaeda, for Boko Haram, for Daesh, for organized crime now in Libya. It is very good environment. And they will use this chance. They will use it. You know, they can grow now in the desert and they can move.
And right now you can't try to fight them because you're defending Tripoli.
Yes, we continue our activity to capture some of them. We are watching, but inside our area, not outside our area. And we are continue our cooperation with USA security and British security. We continue. But out of our front line, what we will do?
US forces have carried out two airstrikes on IS targets in Libya in the past fortnight, in a bid to prevent the militants benefiting from the current chaos. But the longer the conflict continues, the greater the risks for Libya and for the Middle East.
My BBC colleague Orla Guerin there reporting in the Libyan capital, Tripoli. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. TikTok. If you're of a certain age, that's a sound an analog clock makes. If you are a teenager or have one, you're likely not even thinking of a clock. TikTok is a social media app popular all over the world. The company that owns it, ByteDance, is based in China, and that, some say, makes TikTok a target of state censorship, even for users here in the U.S. The World's Lydia Emanalidou reports.
Here's a taste of what it sounds like to scroll through TikTok.
I'm that puff guy.
Respect the drip, Karen.
This app is basically just an endless feed of short videos. There are videos of people lip-syncing, videos of people doing little sketches to the same soundtracks, walk a mile in these Louboutins, videos of people trolling their parents.
Do you guys ever just wonder what it feels like to go downstairs in the middle of the night and get food and not have to try and be quiet for your parents?
And of course, cat videos.
Guys, I don't know what's wrong with my cat.
It's not all memes and fun, though. TikTokers do use the app to talk about global issues like climate change. But if you try to search for videos about the big pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, you're not going to find much. And that might be because of censorship coming from Beijing. So earlier this week, the UK's Guardian newspaper obtained these documents that showed that TikTok was instructing its content moderators to censor videos about topics that might make Beijing look bad. Videos about Tiananmen Square, for example, or Tibetan independence.
I don't think it's surprising because the company ByteDance is a Chinese company. They're, you know, to a large extent, they're accountable to the Chinese government.
Yacha Wang is a China researcher for Human Rights Watch. She spoke to me from Hong Kong. She says the Chinese government has a really tight grip on what people there can and can't say online. And it expects that companies operating in China will take certain steps to keep politically sensitive material off their platforms, even if those platforms are used by people outside of China. So take, for example, WeChat, the Chinese messaging and social media platform. It's huge, not just in China, but among the Chinese diaspora.
Even if you have registered your WeChat account outside China, you're censored. So TikTok is definitely not the first. It's just that TikTok has created and attracted an audience and that it has nothing to do with China, basically.
TikTok launched in 2017, and since then, it's been downloaded more than 100 million times in the U.S. alone, and more than a billion, that's with a B, billion worldwide. It's done better abroad than any other Chinese app has managed to, especially among young people. And this is what worries Wang and others, that the Chinese government has this new opportunity to present a sanitized version of itself to an audience that might not really know a lot about China. For its part, TikTok says that the documents obtained by The Guardian are outdated, that they no longer instruct content moderators to censor those topics. I asked the company about its current policy. Specifically, is what users here in the US see at all affected by rules coming from China? They wouldn't answer that question, but eventually they did send me a statement saying, quote, U.S. content and moderation policies are led by our U.S.-based team. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
TikTok wasn't around in 2011. Still, protesters during Egypt's Arab Spring relied heavily on social media to communicate and convene. Tahrir Square, Cairo, massive protests in 2011 to overthrow the longtime ruler, Hosni Mubarak. Fast forward 8 years, same place, same anger, but now Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is the Egyptian president that demonstrators want out. But do the democracy activists have the same support today that they had in 2011? Joanna Saba is with BBC Monitoring and joins us from Cairo. As we speak, Joanna, Egyptians are in the streets protesting. How big are these protests? What have you been seeing?
So there have been both anti-government protests reported in various neighborhoods in Cairo and in Upper Egypt, but there have also been quite big pro-Sisi demonstrations across Cairo. Last week it was said to be within the hundreds across various different cities. Tahrir Square, the iconic site of the 2011 uprising, has been on lockdown since early this morning. Last week, there were actually protests in Tahrir. That was a first sign of protests, and it was the first protests that we've seen Egyptians explicitly saying that Sisi needs to go.
How quickly did these protests turn from kind of economic grievances to, really, we want the leader out?
Last Friday was the first time that this happened, and it was all on the back of calls by this exiled Egyptian businessman who says he has had a long history of working with the Egyptian army. So he's claimed that there's been widespread corruption by the Egyptian government, and specifically pointing to Sisi and the army and many of the generals within his close circle.
Yeah, so this businessman, his name is Muhammad Ali. Who is he and how did he kind of gain this traction in Egypt?
He was almost an overnight sensation. It started with the release of one video where he said, "The army owes me millions of pounds in unpaid dues. These are the projects that I've been building for the army and for President Sisi, and they've included many palaces, presidential palaces and villas." And all this is happening while, of course, many Egyptians are strained. And according to official figures, actually, almost a third of Egyptians are now found to be living under the poverty level, 32.5%.
So it's interesting, Muhammad Ali, he's in exile in Spain. He's not there in Egypt for these protests. He's kind of fanning the flames from outside the country. How do the protesters feel about that, that they've got a leader, but his investment in democracy in Egypt is from afar?
I think a huge part of that is the consideration is that anyone who would have been that outspoken within Egypt would have very quickly been arrested and silenced. So I think for Egyptians, it's not a strange thing for someone to be speaking from abroad, given that a lot of the opposition has been driven abroad.
I know one interesting detail that you've picked up on is that Muhammad Ali told people not to fear arrest and even suggested that people come out to protest after big soccer matches when the fans go out in the streets to celebrate their teams. Did that strategy work?
Not at all. Rights groups have said that in the past week, over 2,000 people have been arrested, in fact. So any strategy to attempt to sort of avoid arrests hasn't worked so far and doesn't seem to be working, which makes the protests all the more significant because Egyptians do know what risk they're taking in going out to protest.
So are you finding perhaps some of the same demonstrators who were around in 2011 for the Arab Spring are protesting again today, or is there kind of like a generational shift here?
Last week, at least, it became quite clear later on that many of those demonstrating were quite young. They were aged maybe 18, 19 years old. So they would have been in like their tweens or early teens during the first uprising in 2011. So they grew up with this in the background and were familiar with it, but they weren't part of that initial push. So far, we definitely do see a demographic shift, and we do see those who were part of 2011 sort of taking a step back and being more cautious.
BBC Monitoring's Joanna Saba in Cairo speaking with us about the latest protests in Egypt. Joanna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I hope that someone gets my message in a bottle. Sting wrote the lyrics. A Soviet ship captain wrote a real message.
Who knows? Maybe they'll find it in 200 years or 300 years.
50 years have passed since I wrote my note. Keeping hope alive in a bottle, that's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The now infamous phone call between President Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine may have taken your attention away from British politics, but rest assured, across the pond, Brexit has given us another stormy week in Parliament.
No shame today. No shame at all. The fact that this government cynically manipulated the prorogation to shut down this House so that it couldn't work as a democratic assembly. He knows that that is the truth.
That was MP Barry Shearman earlier this week. Some described debates this week as the most toxic and heated ever witnessed in Britain's House of Commons. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been accused of using language that could incite hatred. Meanwhile, the actual negotiations, whether and how to leave the EU, are reportedly underway. The World's Orla Barry has been following the week's events and joins us now from London. Hey, Orla.
Hey, Marco.
We're used to hearing fairly stormy exchanges from the British Houses of Parliament. Why were this week's debates seen as so bitter?
As you know, Boris Johnson returned to Parliament against his wishes this week because the Supreme Court here ruled that his decision to suspend Parliament was unlawful. He had to return, and he was very far from contrite, it had to be said. He told Parliament that the Supreme Court's ruling was wrong. And what really fired up opposition MPs was his continual reference to the bill that was passed a few weeks ago to prevent a no-deal Brexit as a surrender bill. And MPs have said that over the last few days as he keeps on using this rhetoric that they have had this flung in their faces on the streets and by constituents. People are calling them a traitor to the country, and it's become very emotional. And one Labour MP, Paula Sheriff, was particularly emotional about it because she worries that this kind of anger might lead to a repeat of what we saw happened 3 years ago with Labour MP Joe Cox. Joe Cox, you might remember, was a Remainer, an MP with the Labour Party, and she was stabbed and shot dead by a man who was a far-right extremist and at the time said he was doing this for Britain. This was very shortly before the referendum campaign. Take a listen to Paula Sheriff.
We stand here, Mr. Speaker, under the shield of our departed friend, with many of us in this place subject to death threats and abuse every single day. And let me tell the Prime Minister that they often quote his words, surrender act, betrayal, traitor, and I, for one, am sick of it.
Wow, very passionate along with the rest of the hall there. How did Boris Johnson react to these accusations from the MPs?
Yeah, it was this actual retort that I think has really angered MPs.
The best way to honour the memory of Joe Cox, and indeed the best way to bring this country together, would be, I think, to get Brexit done.
Wow. OK, so this strategy by Boris Johnson to use divisive language, it sounds like there, is he just massively frustrated or does he have kind of a strategy?
Well, many believe that this is a strategy and it's an election strategy, a pre-election strategy. So what he's essentially doing is pitching it as the people versus Parliament. So he's representing the people by trying to get Brexit done and that everybody else represents Parliament. And it's a strategy, Marco, that'll be very familiar to people in the US. The idea that, you know, Parliament is against me, the courts are against me, mm-hmm. but here I am trying to represent the voice of the people.
Dare I ask, where does this leave Brexit?
Well, we still have our Brexit deadline of October 31st. But remember, we have had that bill passed that is supposed to mean that Britain can't leave on October 31st without a deal. Johnson says we will leave, but there is genuine concern that he's looking for a loophole to this bill. There is an EU summit on October 17th and the government is to come up with a deal before then. But the reality is, because there is such anger in Parliament here, it's very hard to see how Boris Johnson will be able to get anything through Parliament, because not only are the opposition MPs really divided and very angry, but his own party are really angered.
The World's Orla Barry in London, thanks for summing up another wild week in Brexit land.
You're welcome, Marco.
The Trump administration is once again slashing the number of refugees who will be allowed into the U.S. Starting next month, only 18,000 refugees can resettle here per year. That is the lowest number in the history of the refugee program. Just 2 years ago, the number admitted was nearly six times higher. The Trump administration says it's shifting its focus to processing a backlog of asylum claims, mostly filed by refugees crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins me. What is the Trump administration's justification here, Monica?
Well, it's part of the ongoing strategy to reduce migration of many types to the United States. So in this case, the administration is pointing to the rising number of migrants that we've seen at the U.S.-Mexico border over the past years. And the administration says that until that is resolved, that the refugee program will take a hit. So it's putting a lot of different people seeking another life in the United States into one pot. And the administration sees the refugee program as part of that mix.
So what kind of reaction are you seeing from here within the U.S.?
Well, first, there are those resettlement agencies who advocate for refugees, who accept refugees once they're brought into the United States. And I've talked to a number of advocates who say that the reduction of this program, frankly, you know, the decimation of this program, really does send a signal that the U.S. is no longer taking a leading role in terms of offering refuge to people fleeing persecution of many types around the world. This also, they say, comes at a time when you have more than 20 million refugees worldwide, according to the UN, seeking safety. And I spoke with one person who works at the International Rescue Committee. Mm. Her name is Karen Ferguson. This is what she said in response to the gutting of this program.
It is astonishing that we've moved so far. Even during 9/11,
the presidential ceiling remained at 70,000. It was a message to our country and to the world that as best as possible, we would stay open to persecuted people, even while facing terrorism on our own soil.
So a record low number of admittances for refugees, obviously very discouraging for them. What does it mean, though, practically for refugees?
Well, for refugees in the United States, it means that if they've come here, but perhaps they have immediate family members who were in line but didn't get the chance to resettle in the United States yet, that they may not be reunited with those family members anytime soon. So it means for some refugees in the United States, family separation.
Also, within that new quota of 18,000 refugees, are there any guarantees for certain numbers from certain countries, like Iraqis, for example, who worked with the U.S. military?
So there are. There are several thousand. If you look at the 18,000 figures like a pie and you slice it up, there's a slice for people from Iraq who's worked with the U.S. military. There's a slice for people who are persecuted for their religion. And then there's a very small slice for people, certain people from Central America, 1,500, in fact. Then the balance of that pie is 7,500, and that will account for everybody else who wants to come in. So,
and one more clarification, Monica, because I want to make sure we understand this. Is it through this refugee resettlement program, which is now going down to 18,000, that the migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border applying for asylum will be funneled through, or are they applying for asylum as part of a different quota or number?
These are separate programs. These are separate ways of entering the United States. The refugee program is one in which people are vetted abroad in conjunction with the UNHCR, you know, the UN. People are vetted abroad, brought into the United States, resettled here officially. What we see at the border are people migrating to the U.S.-Mexico border and asking for asylum. It's a different system. There's no cap on the number of asylum, you know, people granted asylum in the United States. There is a cap on the number of people that can be granted refugee status and allowed to resettle in the United States. They're two different groups. They're treated differently. Your question kind of reflects some of the justification that the Trump administration has given for cutting this program, and that they put the asylum seekers at the border, migrants coming in other ways, and refugees into one pot. And so all mixed together, there are a lot of people trying to enter the United States. Let's slash the refugee program. That's one we can do legitimately, you know, and officially. But there isn't a lot of recognition for the realities of the distinctions between people and the way they're treated and the legal process there.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Thanks very much, Monica.
You're welcome.
It is 4 days since summer ended. Never too late, though, for a good summer story like this one from late last month. A man in Alaska found an old bottle washed up on a beach. It contained a message from the past. Charles Maines has a story.
For Tyler Ivanov, it all started when he took his family berry picking last month.
We left Shishmaref about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening because I worked till 5:30.
Shishmaref, an island off the coast of western Alaska. Ivanov is a teacher during the school year, and he'd just gotten off his summer construction job.
We hadn't eaten dinner yet, so we had some hot dogs and some hamburgers to make. And my girlfriend Amber asked me to go collect some driftwood, some firewood to make a fire. And I kind of just stumbled across the bottle.
A green clear bottle, in fact. No label, but tightly sealed. And inside, a note.
You know, I walked up to the bluff to where my family was picking berries, and I went to my kids and showed them the message in a bottle.
A message in a bottle. Mysterious, romantic, like entering a fairy tale. Of course, he opened it.
It was like a really nice paper. There's an outside paper that covered the writing. And so I had to really unravel it and then recognize that it was Russian handwriting.
The date read June 20th, 1969, 50 years ago. Ivanov could make out a few words thanks to a high school Russian class he'd taken to get out of art requirements, but it wasn't enough.
I couldn't, you know, fully translate it, so I stuck it back in the bottle, took a picture of it while I was holding it with my hand, and posted it on Facebook.
When he woke up the next morning, a translation was waiting.
I didn't know what to expect, but it turns out it ended up being coming from a captain of a ship. It basically said, greetings from the ship Sulak. And it just said, to the person who finds this bottle, may you have a long life and
happiness, good health,
all success. Ну, что могу я сказать? Больше...
Yes.
Меня зовут Басаненко Анатолий Прокофьевич.
Анатолий Прокофьевич Басаненко, the mysterious captain and author of The Note. Now 86, he lives in Sevastopol, in annexed Russian Crimea.
Значит, мне позвонил сразу внук.
My grandson called me and said, Grandfather, they found a bottle. You were captain of a ship once, weren't you? Of course I was, I said. And little by little I started to remember.
Back then, Basanenko was 36, the youngest captain of the fleet and in charge of a crew of 250 on a huge fishing vessel based in the Soviet city of Vladivostok. Their ship, the Sulak, says Basanenko, set records for hauls of fish. He and his men were the pride of the fleet, and they knew it.
Everyone says we're such a great crew, but time will pass and they'll forget us and forget this ship someday. And so somebody suggested we put a message in a bottle and throw it overboard. Someone will find it someday.
So the captain, Basanenko, scribbled out a quick note. Heartfelt greetings, he began. Then a few kind words, a return address, and a shipmate sealed the bottle with glue. And that's it. Basanenko watched from the captain's bridge as crewmen pitched the bottle overboard, left side.
We thought maybe someone in the Soviet Union in the Far East of Russia, or maybe Japan or Korea, who knows? Maybe they'll find it in 200 years, or maybe it won't just break up against a rock somewhere.
50 years later, it seemed like it was sealed really well and withstood all the, you know, the rough waters here in the Chukchi Sea. A few days before I found the bottle, there was like a really high storm surge, maybe 6 feet higher than normal. So it may have helped, you know, push it around.
But if Ivanov saw it as a chance discovery, Basanenko says this was fate.
Why did the message from our crew, why did it find him? It means it's because he's a good person. And I want to wish him happiness, health, and success. And not only him, but to the American people. It makes me happy to know that the bottle was found, namely, in America.
Because Basanenko says sooner or later, the U.S. and Russia will get along. The Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Crimea today all taught him. Governments change, but people, they stay mostly the same. For Ivanov, his home state is a reminder. He's part Alaskan Yupik, a tribe that shares ancestry with native Siberians. And then there's that last name, Ivanov. Russians pronounce it Ivanov.
Russians lived in Alaska before other settlers came, you know, and Alaska was purchased from Russia to America. Over in Iqaluit, Alaska, that's where my dad is from, probably like half the village is Ivanov. You know, Russia's not actually that far away.
But it's still far enough away that Ivanov and Basanenko have never spoken. Even in the internet age, they're still trading messages.
Tell him what I said, won't you?
Good health, all success.
Only this time, no bottle necessary.
It was a simple message, but it was really, really pleasant. Yep.
For The World, I'm Charles Maines.
Yep, just a baby crying, but if you're on a plane and that baby, not yours, is right next to you, or in the row in front or back of you, you're lucky it's a short flight. Or there's always Japan Airlines. The airline is making it easier for passengers to avoid sitting near babies. The company has a new online booking tool that shows an icon in seats where children up to 2 years old are seated. No judging here. Hey, we were all babies once. And think about the stressed-out parents flying with their child, trying to soothe them while fighting off dirty looks from passengers, sometimes even before the babies open their mouths. Still, a little distance from that baby would be nice. But, and there's always a but, Japan Airlines says they can't guarantee that the seat you choose will be out of earshot of a screaming infant, and according to the Japan Airlines website, the child icon will not appear if passengers book their flight through a third party or were part of a tour group. or if there was a last-minute change of aircraft. So here's another thought on what to do about crying babies. Maybe we need to change our attitude. Again, think of the poor parents, lugging bottles, snacks, diapers, and toys on board.
Am I forgetting anything? Is he going to be occupied on the airplane? I don't want to be that lady with the baby who's screaming for 4 hours.
That's an ad from JetBlue from Mother's Day 3 years ago. On a flight from New York to Long Beach, California, a flight attendant made a surprise announcement for the 140 passengers on board.
This will be the very first flight where crying babies is a good thing. Every time a baby on this plane cries, you'll receive 25% off your next JetBlue flight. In other words, 4 cries is equivalent to a free round-trip ticket.
By the time the plane started its descent, the official scorekeeper ruled that 3 babies had sufficient outbursts, so close to a free ticket. But then...
Max did it. Let's give it up for Max, Donovan, Leela, Beck, and Reese.
Yes, this was a one-time promotion, but one with a larger message. Next time, have a little sympathy for a baby and their caregiver. Or just book your flight on Japan Airlines. Guitar bands from the Sahara Desert have been a thing for a few years, Tenariwen and Tamikrest, to name two. The musicians in most of these bands are men and come primarily from the Tuareg ethnic group. But now the first Tuareg all-female ensemble is on the rise. There's a small village in rural Niger in West Africa called Iligadad, and it's here where guitarist Fatou Seydi Gali is from. Iligadad is in the bush, she told me, in the middle of nowhere. There's no electricity, lots of camels and sheep. Only shepherds live there. This is where Fatou Seydi Gali grew up and continues to make music with her group, Les Filles de Iligadad, the Daughters of Iligadad. Les Filles de Iligadad includes her cousin and other women from the village, but family members and neighbors are always welcome to sing and clap. Women who play the guitar in Niger are rare. Fatou put her hands on a guitar, her brother's, for the first time as a teenager. She says, for the people in my village, a woman playing guitar was something they'd never seen. It was strange for many of my friends and family, Fatou says. She had to practice in secret, but Fatou kept at it and got her chops together, then went public about her passion for the guitar. These days, she and her band Les Filles de Iligadad tour the world, and when they get back to their village of Iligadad in Niger, it is like the return of the prodigal daughters. The band is in Indiana and Ohio this weekend. Catch them if you can. Next week here on The World, the rise of a crown prince and the death of a journalist. A year after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi agents in Istanbul, we look at the crime, the aftermath, and we get to know Khashoggi himself. We'll hear from his fiancée and one of his colleagues in the media.
Jamal was not someone who was out there to join forces with the crazy extremist Islamists who want to finish off the Saudi monarchy. He was being critical for the sake of Saudi Arabia, not against Saudi Arabia.
You'll also hear from the late Khashoggi himself.
Of course, I will risk being arrested or being banned from travel.
He spoke with us on The World 1 year before his death.
So Prince Mohammed bin Salman is kind of spying on people or having people keep track of who is writing negatively about him?
I'm not saying Prince Mohammed bin Salman is doing that. No, it's not him. It's not him. But this is happening under his watch. It is not him who's spying. It's not him who's intimidating, but this is happening under his watch, and I urge him to stop it. He needs to stop that.
And we'll hear from Martin Smith, journalist at PBS Frontline, who had the first interview with Mohammed bin Salman after the Khashoggi murder.
You know, I said, look, in a sense, it doesn't matter whether you ordered this or not. You're in charge here. And he says, right, it happened on my watch. He actually said to me, I'm not going to say I did it or that I didn't do it. That's just words.
We mark 1 year since the death of Jamal Khashoggi. That's next week, right here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Be safe and have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.